for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Investigators search for motives in the apparently deliberate crashing of a passenger plane into the French Alps. A Saudi Arabian-led coalition launches airstrikes in Yemen, and Afghan President Ashraf Ghani addresses the U.S. Congress, thanking lawmakers for American support and sacrifices. Joining me for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Mark Landler of The New York Times, Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, and Paul Danahar of the BBC. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And it's good to see all of you.
Good to see you, too.
Thank you.
Good morning, Diane.
Thank you. And to you, Mark Landler. From what we are learning about this plane crash, there doesn't seem to be any active terrorism involved.
Yeah, the authorities in both France and Germany have at the moment, at least, discounted terrorism as a likely cause of this accident. And indeed, all the focus is now on the mental condition of the co-pilot of this Germanwings plane, who, as we all know now, actually locked the cockpit door and prevented the captain of the plane from re-entering after he had left, and apparently engaged the autopilot in a way that brought the plane into a fairly gradual but sudden descent into the French Alps. And the new information on this has to do with what he may have not told his employers about a medical condition. They discovered some notes in his home in the Rhineland indicating that a doctor had excused him from work on the day of the crash, and another note that had been torn up. And so there does seem to be evidence that he had a medical condition that he had withheld from his employer. And, of course, the next question is, what was the nature of that medical condition?
And just a few moments ago, CNN reported that a letter was found in a waste bin near Lubitz's apartment indicating he was, quote, declared by a medical doctor unfit to work. And that is from Dusseldorf prosecutor Christoph Kumpa.
Yeah, there's been some information coming out of the German newspaper Bild as well that said that he'd spent a year and a half receiving psychiatric treatment, that he even had it marked on his pilot's license saying that he'd been receiving regular medical examinations. So that didn't actually state what kind of examinations they were. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Europe is it is different from America in the sense that, A, they don't have what they call four eyes in the cabin at all times, i.e. two people. The other thing is that they are examined, but it's a verbal examination, and there is an element of trust. You have a conversation with these guys, and you say, are you feeling okay? And he says, yeah. Are you fit to fly? And he says, yeah. And there's a general conversation, but at no stage is there a really deep examination, a psychological examination, carried out by a professional during this six-month medical examination they have. It's mainly about, can you physically fly? Are you able to fly? You know, are you drinking? But it's not about your psychiatric kind of sense of yourself.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of differences between U.S. law and European law in this way, including the ability of outsiders to get into the cockpit. As Paul mentioned, the question of how many people have to be in the cockpit at one time. In this country, you have to have two people in the cockpit at all times. If one leaves, if the pilot leaves, if someone has to use the facilities and leave, someone else has to walk in and be there with the co-pilot.
And hasn't Germany already made the decision to change that rule, Mark?
Yes. All the German airlines have now said that they will institute the two-person rule, as have several other major European carriers, including EasyJet. You know, it's worth noting that the chairman of German Wings at the news conference yesterday was asked about the two-person rule, and he raised the possibility that it may not have made a difference. If this young man was determined to bring this plane down, and if a flight attendant, for example, was in the cockpit, it's not absolutely clear that she could have prevented or he could have prevented that from happening. So there is an element of kind of the unpredictability of the human condition in all this, where if someone is determined to crash a plane, all the safety procedures you can think of may not prevent that outcome.
What about cameras, Paul? Is there some talk of placing cameras in the cockpit?
Yeah, but then a camera would tell you what happened. It wouldn't stop you stopping something happening.
Exactly.
And I think that's the key thing here. There obviously will be a big change in the way the European airlines think about safety. There always are. But you know, it's not unprecedented. We have had a couple of cases in the past. There was an Egyptian airliner that went down. There's one in Africa. And that are unexplained. And people think, well, it must have been the pilot. And they look back into their histories and they find that these guys have got some kind of psychiatric problem. But it's very rare. So do you completely reorganize everything you do and the way that you run your airline for these very rare occurrences? How far can you go?
So what do we know about the differences between how an American pilot is investigated and a European pilot is investigated for mental health? Do we know differences?
Well, certainly in the UK, as I said, it's a very general conversation.
Right.
And pilots have talked about the fact that they really never have a rigorous examination into their mental health. I'm not sure about the American system, but certainly in Europe, it's about physical capacity.
Mark.
Well, we had in the New York Times an op-ed from a person who worked as a commercial pilot in the U.S. for about 12 years, and he said that even in the United States, in terms of psychological screening, there's not extensive psychological screening of pilots for their mental condition. And he said that there is a lot of screening for the state a pilot's in on the day he turns up to work. And in fact, pilots are trained to deal with a co-pilot who shows up drunk, for example, who shows up obviously incapacitated. But in terms of the kind of the deeper psychological issues, this pilot, former pilot, made the point that, you know, some things will always remain a mystery. And he said, you know, that was interesting. In his years of flying, he flew with people that would describe very messy personal lives and how they misbehaved when they were on the road. He flew with people that were evangelical Christians and spoke about the Bible in the cockpit. And so he said he encountered all the vast variety of people that you'd meet everywhere in the world in the cockpit. And that always underscored to him that you never know 100% who that person is who's sitting in the seat next to you.
Well, I think, and the other thing is, you know, this, they have the voice recorder from the cockpit, and it's a 30-minute tape, and the first 20 minutes are of what they've described as a completely normal conversation between the two pilots, chatting about various things on the plane, talking about their lives. The pilot then excuses himself, leaving the co-pilot alone, and he never utters another word, despite the ground people calling him, asking what was going on, banging on the door, never speaks again. So, again, it's difficult to know how you can plan for something like this.
It's not only he doesn't speak, his breath doesn't change.
Exactly.
His whole demeanor doesn't change. If you can crash a plane into a mountain without catching a breath, it's very difficult for anyone else to be able to see what's going on in your head, because he was obviously incredibly calm when he crashed a plane, when he was talking to his colleagues. I mean, what is interesting is apparently he was at a Lufthansa flight school in Phoenix, Arizona, and they designated him not suitable for flying. So whether they picked up something that perhaps wasn't picked up within systems in Europe, I don't know. But obviously, he had a history. He had some problems. I guess the question will now be, if you have any history of mental illness, will that rule you out in the future flying planes?
But why would Lufthansa hire him if the Arizona school here in the U.S. had said he shouldn't be flying?
Well, he wouldn't. Well, I don't think they would have had him flying until someone else said he was fit to fly. I think that's what the question will now be is, if you have any history, does that rule you out? And if you do have a history, will you be able to hide it, or will the investigations be much tighter?
Well, and again, the Arizona School, as I understand it, is part of the Lufthansa training system. In other words, it wasn't a separate thing that where they wouldn't have reported to Lufthansa. It was a second stage in a three-stage training process that went on for about 3 years.
So now, you know, there are an awful lot of people who are going to wonder every single time they get on a plane, are they fortunate enough to have a Captain Sully Sullenberger, or are they unfortunate enough to have this young man in the cockpit?
And what's interesting about this is, in the aftermath of 9/11, of course, what we worried about as flying travelers was who was sitting in the seats next to us and what were the odds that they might storm the cockpit or try to take control of the aircraft.
So much trust placed in that cockpit.
Right. And that and that in turn led to all these heavy security procedures to turn the cockpit into a fortress. And that security process, in a way, is what led to this incident. Because if the captain had been able to enter an old-fashioned cockpit door, this may not have happened.
Mark Lattner, New York Times, Karen DeYoung at The Washington Post, Paul Danaher, the BBC. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in Yemen. Take your calls. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, from CFP. On behalf of certified financial planner professionals committed to the highest standard in personal financial advice to help plan for major life events and reaching financial goals at letsmakeaplan.org. And the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org.
Welcome back to the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, this week with Karen DeYoung at The Washington Post, Paul Danaher of the BBC, and Mark Landler of the New York Times. Paul Danaher, how did the Saudi military intervention in Yemen come about?
Well, they were deeply concerned because basically the president of Yemen had been kicked out of power by the Houthi rebels, who are backed by Iran. They were sitting on the sidelines, and they're next door to Yemen, and they don't want to see a big country next door being controlled by an Iranian-backed power. And they didn't see anybody else was going to do anything about it. And I think what's interesting about this is it does show, I think, a more muscular approach, if you like, of the Arab powers, because this is a coalition, which is interesting. And it's a few weeks ago that the new Saudi king, King Salman, was showing that he was trying to put aside some of their differences over things like the Muslim Brotherhood and political Islam and start pulling together a sense that, you know what, if the Americans are not going to get as involved in the Middle East as they used to, well, we are. And I think what we're seeing now is this almost undeclared proxy war going on with Iran, between the Saudis and Iran, is now moving into a new stage, which is very declared. We're now seeing airstrikes, and we're seeing a big coalition of countries, you know, threatening to go into Yemen.
Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the UAE, Turkey, Egypt. What interested me was that Senator McCain came out and said, why weren't we notified before this strike began, Karen?
Well, I think according to U.S. and Saudi officials, that's just not true. The planning for the possibility of some kind of intervention began way last summer when the Houthi started moving toward Sana'a before they even took over Sana'a, the Yemeni capital. I think that there were, as they took over, as they formed what was described as a power-sharing agreement with the Yemeni president, in which there wasn't much power shared. It was mostly held by the Houthis. I think concern grew. Last month, the Yemeni president fled, went to Aden, the second city of Yemen on the coast. Saudis and the Americans and many others made overtures to the Houthis, asked for some kind of negotiated settlement. They didn't get it. The Houthis made common cause with the former president of Yemen, who retained control over some military troops who have been participating in this on the Houthi side. And I think it was only over the weekend that things started to get to the point where they decided there had to be some intervention. They went to their allies. They came to the United States. They planned very closely with the United States.
So why, Mark Landler, would Senator McCain come out and say, we were not consulted beforehand?
Well, Senator McCain may be wrong on the facts in this case, but what he's getting at, I think, is a broader criticism that the United States, because of its disengagement in recent years, finds itself as more of a bystander in what's become a very inter-Arab conflict. And not just a bystander, but it finds itself oddly on all sides of Iran and Saudi Arabia. If you think of Iran and Saudi Arabia as the two great enemies in this battle, we're now helping the Saudis with intelligence and other things in Yemen, but we're helping Iran indirectly in its battle, in our battle against ISIS in Iraq, where we find ourselves in Tikrit, where we've actually begun airstrikes, on the same side as Iranian-backed Shia militia. So the United States, at this very complicated moment in the Arab world, looks like we don't have much of a policy. The administration's argument is, well, it's complicated. The Arabs have a vote. You know, things haven't played out the way we wanted it to. But to people like Senator McCain, it just looks like we're now at the mercy of events, hostage to things that are out of our control. And that reflects a broader level of disengagement with the region.
I mean, I think also if you look at the bombing that took place in Libya by the UAE, supported by the Egyptians, the Americans were not consulted about that. So this is, I imagine McCain is saying, well, you know, it wouldn't be the first time, and it wouldn't have been the first time, although they did consult them this time. I think what is interesting, though, as Mark was saying, was this is all part of a bigger puzzle. It was interesting today that some of the Syrian Islamist rebel groups came out and said that they supported Saudi's action in Yemen against the Iranians. So And they were coordinated, these responses. Obviously, someone told them to say it. So you've now got, you know, the Islamist groups that are obviously being supported by the Saudis in Syria talking about sectarianism. So you've got sectarian fighting all over the region now, and it's not being hidden anymore under different guises. It's just out there.
I think it's fair to say that the proximate cause of Senator McCain's remarks was testimony by General Austin yesterday morning. He's the head of the U.S. Central Command, who was asked when he was notified that the operation was going to go forward, and he said just a couple of hours before it started. That was later explained as being that was when the go order came, and that was when the troops were advised. I do think that there is some merit, obviously, in what's been said in terms of this being an incredibly confusing situation and all sides kind of mixed up. I will say, speaking, which I don't like to do, for the Obama administration, they, I think, would say now, look, we have encouraged the Persian Gulf allies to form their own military, you know, coalition. This is part of our policy. We don't want to be involved everywhere, and we think countries in the region should be involved. The question, of course, is whether it gets out of hand and becomes a complete sectarian war all the way across the region.
And now Saudi Arabia is talking about building a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, and that actually is a direct result of the one factor we haven't all talked about yet, but it's vital to understanding the dynamic, and that's the fact that we're in the late stages of a potential nuclear agreement with Iran. John Kerry's in Lausanne, Switzerland. There was a meeting again today. The pictures from the meeting make it look like it wasn't a particularly good session. But the fact is there's now a belief that we may have a greater than 50% chance of at least some sort of a framework agreement. That agreement would be deeply unsettling to the Saudis, not just the Saudis, the Israelis, the Emiratis, our traditional allies in the region. I think underlying much of what's going on is a fear that the nuclear deal represents some sort of a broader realignment where the United States would edge closer to Iran and hence further away from its original Sunni allies in the region. And so when the United States comes in on the side of Saudi Arabia, they want to send a strong signal to the Saudis and the world that we have your back, that whatever we're doing with Iran does not represent us stepping away from you. And the Saudis, in raising this issue of a nuclear weapon, are getting at something that many people have long worried about, which is that a nuclear Iran sets off an arms race in the region, and that it's hard to imagine the Saudis would sit by and allow a nuclear Iran, its great historic foe in the region, to exist without itself going in that direction.
So you're saying there's a 50-50 chance that we could have an agreement by the end of March? What do you think?
The British Foreign Secretary, who is here this week, had a session with reporters this morning. He said he thought that better than 50% of the issues, the main outstanding issues, had now been resolved or were on their way to being resolved.
And then the question remains, can you trust Iran even if you do get that agreement, Paul?
Well, the answer that many people in the Gulf and in Israel would say is no, you can't. And they've lied in the past. Why wouldn't they lie in the future? The American administration says there will be systems in place to stop them. We're not trusting them. We are going to verify everything that they say. I think the big problem we have in the Middle East at the moment is American policy doesn't have a solid narrative. So as Mark was saying, one minute we're kind of working with the Iranians and next minute we're helping someone else fight them somewhere else. And if you're sitting in the Gulf, you're kind of thinking, well, you know, they changed their policy. I mean, the Americans are the only ones, say, in Syria that have kept changing their policy. Everybody else, the Turks and the Iranians and the Russians, they know what they're going to do. They've been doing it all the way through. And I think that's where some of the uncertainty comes from.
So why is it that the U.S. cannot have a single policy toward the entire region? It is too complicated.
It's very complicated.
There are no easy answers, Mark.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things the administration made a decision to do a long time ago when they started down this road with Iran was to really try to compartmentalize the nuclear negotiation, not have it be a broad discussion about Iranian-backed militias in Lebanon, for example, or Iranian-backed groups in Yemen. I think one of the things, if there is a framework agreement in the next month, one of the things you'll see spinning out in the debate is to what extent do you now need to embed whatever nuclear deal you have in a broader effort to push back on Iran's behavior in the region? Because Iran in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen is viewed by the Sunni world as a country on the move, sort of really trying to create hegemony in the region. And I think the administration has sort of said to our allies, look, let us do this negotiation with Iran because it's good for everybody if we get it done. But if they succeed in that, they're now going to have to contend with how do you deal with Iran's behavior on all these other fronts and this very, very complicated role it's playing throughout the region.
And the manner in which Israel is brought in and the relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama and Iran and how that issue is affecting that relationship.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the relationship at the moment between Israel and the United States is the worst that it's been, certainly in recent memory. President Obama had a press conference this week and emphasized that this was not a question of his personal relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu. He said, you know, we have our differences, our conversations are businesslike. I think it is a lot about the personal relationship, but it's also the much larger question of Israel. I think on all sides, they do not want the deal with Iran. They think that it is potentially damaging to them. They view this as their number one national security priority. And there are a lot of ears in this country that are willing to listen to them.
But what about the president of Israel speaking to Netanyahu about that relationship with President Obama?
Well, I think, you know, the Israeli president has made it clear, even though he's a right-winger himself, he's made it clear, as most Israelis believe, that the American relationship is incredibly important. And I think, you know, the fundamentals of it, which are the security arrangements, they're not going to change. But what we're talking about with all these negotiations is people trusting people to act on their behalf. And there's no trust whatsoever between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu. And that makes it more complicated. And I think, you know, when you're saying to people, trust me, we will be compartmentalizing this, it's not part of a grand bargain, he's not being trusted by the people he's trying to persuade.
Paul Danahar, he's Washington Bureau Chief of the BBC and author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to you, Mark Lantler, what about the impact of recent reports that Israel has been spying on these U.S.-Iran negotiations?
Well, the Israelis reacted by saying, we never spy on the United States, which is something that no one on either side takes seriously. Israel has a very professional, aggressive intelligence service. There's evidence that they eavesdropped on John Kerry when he was engaged in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiation. So the fact is, there's little surprise the Israelis would try to find out what was being discussed with the U.S. and Iran. Some people have suggested that perhaps Israel was actually spying on the Iranians as opposed to the United States. But the goal would be the same, which is to figure out what is the emerging shape of a nuclear deal. I don't think, honestly, that this is the type of story that's more than a 1 or 2 day irritant in a relationship that has so many other deeper problems, both the personality problems we've talked about with the president and the prime minister, and these real strategic differences over whether we should do a nuclear deal. And I'd add the issue of the two-state solution and the Palestinians into the category of things where our interests in the Israelis at the moment appear to be diverging. I don't think Prime Minister Netanyahu was that far off the reservation when he said in the closing days of the election that he didn't believe in a two-state solution. Increasingly in Israel, you don't have to talk much or think much about a two-state solution. A lot of the issues with the Palestinians have been put behind that big wall that they built.
But how successfully did he backtrack from that statement, Paul?
Not very successfully, I don't think, certainly in the way that the Obama administration looked at it. I think the thing we haven't talked about so far was his comment about droves of Arabs, because I think that was a particularly significant thing, because I think for many people in America who support Israel, they support the idea of Israel as a vibrant democracy, a Jewish state, but a vibrant democracy. And in Israel, and I think in America, what was seen as an attack on minorities trying to exercise their vote went down very badly. And I think the White House talked about it undermining the shared values between the two nations. And I think Netanyahu has realized that really was a bad mistake. The president of Israel has also come down him for that. But these kind of issues about how Israel is seen by the administration, by America, and the trust between the two. I think that particular remark really did damage the personal relationship between Obama and Netanyahu.
I think it also perhaps did some damage to Netanyahu's standing in this country, in the Jewish community in this country. I think people, you know, a lot of people in this country maybe are on the political left of center or in the center, but still support a strong defense of Israel, and for that reason are opposed to the Iranian negotiations and other things. But I think that this was a sort of shocking statement to them. This was something that Netanyahu said late in the day on election day, sent out a tweet calling on right wing by name. He called them, you know, right leaning people to go out and vote because he said the Arab Israelis were turning out in droves and they presumably were voting for his opponent. So I think that that did give a lot of people here pause. I think Paul's right, perhaps even more so than the comment on the two-state solution, which nobody, I think, really believed he was ever for it.
And you know, the only I absolutely agree with that. And the one thing I'd add is that people here likened it to incidences of race baiting in some of our own elections. So not only was it was offensive in a way that echoed with things in our own country that have been sort of unfortunate. I guess the one point I'd make about Obama and Netanyahu is I think we can all agree that relationship is not likely to be repaired. And the focus now is on how Bibi will get along with whoever the next U.S. president is.
Mark Lantner at the New York Times. Short break here. We'll take your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the ACLU with its Smart Justice, Fair Justice campaign to end mass incarceration. Learn more at aclu.org/massincarceration. From Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. And from Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors. On the web at pamm.org.
The new PBS documentary series, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies, presented by Ken Burns, is based on a book by oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee, which looks back on the history of cancer and its treatments and looks ahead to treatments in development. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Dr. Mukherjee. The PBS series premieres Monday. Join us.
Welcome back. Time to open the phones and read your emails. Several like this. Why is it a bad thing if we back off and let the Middle East take care of the Middle East? Paul Danaher.
Yeah, the thing about the Middle East, it doesn't abide by the Vegas rules. You know, what happens there doesn't stay there, unfortunately. It tends to kind of go everywhere else in the world. We could try it. it hasn't worked, but then neither has intervention. So it's a possibility. But I think the problem is that once people get a foothold in the Middle East, like we had with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, they then look for ways to attack the West. And the concern now in Syria is that that's being used as a base by this Khorasan group to possibly attack America. So how do you deal with it if you let it fester?
Mark?
I think if you look at the arc of the Obama presidency, it was an effort, a strong effort, to do exactly what your emailer suggests, which is to withdraw and leave some of the Arab world to the Arabs. I mean, that explains in part President Obama's refusal to get drawn into the Syrian civil war. It also represents the degree to which we've promoted our increasing energy independence, the fact that we now, because of shale oil extraction, we're not so dependent on the Middle East for fossil fuels.
And doesn't the president's attitude reflect that of the American people at this moment?
Well, you know, that's interesting. In general terms, the American people are weary. They're not interested in another land war in the Middle East. The war in Iraq was deeply unpopular, as was the war in Afghanistan. That said, specific things in the Middle East are still capable of drawing a strong public reaction in the United States. For example, when the young journalists were beheaded in Syria, there were several polls done on would you support military action in the wake of that. The numbers were surprisingly strong, as they've been on the question of would you support some ground element in the fight against ISIS in Iraq. So there's a bit of a dissonance in American public opinion between a general combat fatigue, but still a capacity to be outraged and to want the U.S. to take action in response to certain things.
And here's an email on Yemen. President Obama has spent many months trying to get the Middle East to step up and take responsibility. But when the Saudis attacked in Yemen, we heard John McCain using it as an excuse to criticize Obama once again. Does John McCain not understand the strategy?
One could argue whether he understands the strategy to the extent he believes he understands it. He certainly doesn't agree with it and thinks it is not a strategy. There is a very constant criticism of what is described as a failure of the administration to lead. And I think that this gave, because the United States was not in the lead in this particular operation, it was not even involved in terms of actual troops. I think that gave an excuse to once again come out and say they don't have a strategy, they don't know what they're doing. I mean, you also saw John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, yesterday come out and say the Obama administration is sitting on the sidelines, which I think is a fairly extreme view considering what's going on in Iraq and Syria at the moment.
I think part of the problem was that the Americans did try and do that in 2012 with Syria, and they allowed the Gulf Cooperation Council to get involved and try and do peacekeeping. And all that happened was all these people rushed in and started buying up their own proxies and paying for different militia groups, and it completely fell apart. And I think, you know, the problem is where the West is kind of handing it over to people that aren't very good at doing it either. Do you trust the Saudis to act responsibly and try and set up a democratic state? Well, the Saudis are not democratic themselves. I mean, their human rights abuse record is appalling. So you're asking people that we criticize constantly for the way that they run their own countries to go and sort out somebody else's country that's already falling apart. So
all right, to Ken in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. A very devoted listener, like so many of us. But I wanted to compare what we are calling terrorist groups in the Middle East to a lot of the organized crime groups that we're seeing in a lot of other places in the world. You know, ISIS and the Taliban have a different recruiting model, you know, compared to, you know, the Zetas and Sinaloa. But there's a lot of overlap between their business models, you know, kidnapping and drug smuggling. Now, organized crime, you know, depends on, you know, paying off local politicians and police, and then on money laundering. You know, so the what ends, I think, organized crime is not so much, you know, top-down application of force. You know, we don't need more guns. We need more civil society, you know.
Well, I mean, I think the administration recognizes some of what you're saying in the way they've treated Afghanistan. It hasn't just been about guns. Much of it has, of course. But there's also been an emphasis on rooting out corruption and building up local institutions. And I think that gets at some of what you're saying, because you're talking about making local authorities strong enough and incorruptible enough that organized crime-like elements can't infiltrate. So I'd say there's a recognition of that. But with ISIS and the Taliban, there's no question that they're still viewed as, because they have such a strong political and religious orientation, that they can't be dealt with the same way that you deal with a drug cartel, for example.
All right. Let's talk about Afghanistan and President Ghani's visit to Washington this week, his meeting with President Obama, and his statement before a joint session of Congress.
Well, this was President Ghani's first trip to the United States since he was elected and installed as president. I think what was so notable about it was the very stark difference between him and President Hamid Karzai, who had been president of Afghanistan really ever since the U.S. Involvement there started. President Ghani could not have been more outspoken, saying at every conceivable opportunity, "Thank you, United States," listing the number of U.S. troops that had died, the number that had been wounded, thanking U.S. taxpayers for spending money. Unlike Karzai saying, "We really don't want the Americans here. They're interlopers. They have built corruption here. They need to get out," while saying privately, "You need to stay." Ghani was very upfront, saying, "We want these agreements with the United States," asking President Obama to leave the current number of troops there beyond what Obama said he was going to do, and getting that agreement from President Obama. So I think he was all about, "We're grateful. We love you, Americans." You know, and he, one of the differences is he spent a long time in this country. And I think his
Both
very
he and his wife.
Yes, I think he's very cognizant of what politics are in this country, and was very good at it.
And the other thing that Ashraf Ghani did, which was interesting in that speech to Congress, is he did raise the specter of ISIS coming to Afghanistan. And the truth is, the evidence of that is fairly anecdotal and small scale. But I think he was trying to say, in a way, to the United States, "Look, don't leave us, to our own fate here. You know, we want you to stay.
We've got to be stronger before you go."
And to invoke ISIS, which is such a deeply emotional and fearsome image in the United States at the moment, was a fairly calculated effort, I think, on his part, to give Congress a reason to pressure the White House and allow President Obama to do what he appears to be doing anyway, which is to slow down the scale of the pace of the withdrawal of American troops. The 9,800 he's now going to leave on the ground through 2015. He had planned to take it down by half. And so clearly this goal that he has of having virtually no troops left except for a small vestigial presence when he leaves office, that's probably not going to happen at this point.
It was also slightly disingenuous in the sense that there's a big battle going on between the Taliban and ISIS over who is the real caliphate. The Taliban are saying, "We've got a caliphate. We've got Mullah Omar. He's the real kind of, he should be the one that's looked at and revered." And the ISIS are saying, "No, it's al-Baghdadi." So there really aren't much in the way of connections between ISIS and the Taliban. There certainly are remnants of al-Qaeda floating around in Afghanistan, but that was a very, very calculated point, as Mark was saying, to kind of raise the bogeyman, the big bogeyman now of ISIS. But the reality is that ISIS would end up fighting the Taliban if they tried to move in, because their visions about who should be running everything are very different.
And here's a question from Kurt in Byron, Illinois. He says, as fighting erupts in yet another country, and he's talking about Yemen, I'm at a loss to understand what everyone is fighting for. Seems much of the fighting comes down to a Shiite group supported by Iran fighting a Sunni group supported by Saudi Arabia. Is there any military, including the new Iraq army, that has both Shiite and Sunni members.
Well, the big problem with the Iraqi army is that they're seen as deeply sectarian, and deliberately so. That was Maliki's deliberate plan, to have control over the Iraqi forces. The problem we have now in Iraq is that a lot of the fighting has been done by Shia militia, who in some cases are not even acting upon the orders of the Iraqi army. They're acting on the orders of Iranian generals. And so this sectarianization of military forces around the Arab world is getting worse and worse, and there doesn't seem to be any real way to kind of rein it in.
And back to Afghanistan, at the funeral this week for a young woman beaten to death by a mob, and there were all women pallbearers, how much attention is this actually getting in Afghanistan? How is President Ghani responding?
I think that it's getting relatively a lot of attention. You've had several big demonstrations in Afghanistan with women and men and young people coming out. I think what was so shocking about this is that it wasn't kind of ne'er-do-wells in the street who attacked this woman, beat her to death, set her on fire, dragged her body, and threw it in a riverbed. It was well-dressed, ostensibly educated Afghan young people, the very young people that we say and that President Ghani has said are the future of Afghanistan. And so that was notable, but it's also notable the response to it. These are things that are not unusual occurrences in Afghanistan, albeit more unusual in metropolitan Kabul. And so what was more unusual was the response to it. Ghani, I think, in referring to it, was spoke out both on behalf of his wife and himself about the need to bring women more into society. It's an issue he has to be very careful about, as his wife has been very careful about talking about it, but with an unmistakable message.
I think every American probably ought to read The Kite Runner and its sequel, both characterizations of Afghanistan that we've never really understood. And that woman never even tore a page out of the Quran.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, Karen raises correctly that there has been this popular response. On the other hand, it also has to be said that in the immediate aftermath of the attack, there were some presenters on television who said that it was understandable. There were some government ministers who said it was understandable. There was a leading imam who said that the police shouldn't have arrested these people because they were right to show their outrage. So that even as there are people on the streets, there are members of the Afghan government and religious elite and establishment who are not speaking out against this. And that's deeply problematic.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show.
I mean, the fact is, in the rural areas of Afghanistan, she wouldn't have been allowed out on her own. I mean, Afghanistan is a deeply conservative country. I remember after the Taliban fell from Kabul, driving down to Ghazni and talking to some of the local tribesmen and said, so, you know, now you can send your children to school. And they were like, no way. They're staying exactly where they are. So in some of the big cities and in Kabul, there has been an attempt to try and give women their rights back. But in many, many parts of Afghanistan, it hasn't moved at all. For centuries.
All right. And final call from Scott in Columbia, Missouri. You're on the air. Scott, are you there?
Yes, Diane.
Go right ahead, sir.
I'm curious, 13 and a half years ago when we had the 9/11 incident, the American dialogue was talking about sky marshals in our planes in order to deal with the possibility of the planes being seized from their control. We're now 13 years later, and we're now talking about needing to keep a watch on pilots. We've had the shoe bomber incident. We've had numerous people causing a variety of incidents in flight that stressed the cabin out. I don't understand why we don't have the political will in Congress to pass a federal law instituting sky marshals in all of our planes of, say, 50 passengers or more.
Don't we have them here in the U.S.?
The sky marshals are on some flights, but not all. The public is not supposed to know which flights they're on or even how they decide which flights to be on.
I see.
But I would say the caller, I'm not sure that having sky marshals present in the plane that's something that's designed for unruly passengers and for possible terrorism among the passengers, would have done much in this particular situation.
Can I say something as a European that's going to upset everybody? I don't understand why understandably zero tolerance towards any kind of incident like this. And, you know, do we have people with guns on the plane to stop this happening? And yet there is a tolerance for guns in schools and guns in lots of other places. And it kind of feels to me that there's a big issue here. And as a European, I don't really understand some of the logic of why it's really important to kind of have zero tolerance here and not to have zero tolerance in other places.
European planes do not have a regulation for sky marshals of any sort.
I believe that they do, depending if, you know, big international flights. But locally, I don't believe that they do.
Do you think that's going to change here at all? Are we going to see, indeed, even tougher regulations on national flights now that this has occurred?
I would think that they're going to review the regulations for pilots and make sure that they've got coverage over every possible eventuality that they can think of. I'm not sure it's going to change with the marshals. First of all, I don't think they don't have enough marshals to go around at the moment to do that.
And there is probably no way to keep all planes 100% safe. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Diane.
Mark Landler at the New York Times, Karen DeYoung at the Washington Post, Paul Danahar at the BBC. Have a great weekend, everybody, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.